This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. About 26 years ago, the Trumpet's editor-in-chief, Gerald Fleury, said that Iran was going to take over Iraq. Now, at the time, that didn't make much sense, apart from the fact that he saw how it was prophesied in the Bible that this would take place. And in the time since then, 26 years, we've seen this prophecy coming to pass step by step. And we're going to talk with Trumpet writer Brent Noctegal to discuss the latest, most powerful evidence of this trend, some statements that were made by the United States Secretary of State this past weekend, and the response by Iraqi and Iranian leaders. Japan's prime minister was struggling politically just a few months ago, very low approval ratings. But last month, he called snap elections, and this past Sunday, he won them decisively. Why did he call the elections, and what changed? Well, most importantly, what does he plan to do now that he has such a strong public mandate? We'll talk with Trumpet writer Jeremiah Jacques about this story. Some interesting political machinations going on inside the Vatican. Pope Francis is taking steps that weaken the power of the bureaucracy of the Holy See and that concentrate more power in his own office. This actually could hasten the fulfillment of a couple of biblical prophecies. We're going to talk with Trumpet writer Andrew Miller about what's happening there. And finally, I'll give you three practical ways that you can build more passion in your life. All this on today's Trumpet Hour. The United States has been deeply involved in Iraq since the Iraq War began in 2003. It'll be 15 years this coming spring. So America has invested a tremendous amount of energy and manpower, military resources, wealth. We've lost about 5,000 Americans over there. What is the end result of all that expenditure? Well, it's becoming clearer and clearer that Iraq is a strong ally, not of the U.S., but of Iran. This is truly an extraordinary development, especially because this is exactly what the Trumpet's editor-in-chief, Gerald Fleury, said would happen more than a decade before the Iraq War even started, based on the prophecies of the Bible. More evidence of Iran's victory in Iraq emerges all the time. And to talk about the latest of this evidence, via Skype from Jerusalem, we have Trumpet writer Brent Noctegal. Hello, Brent.
Hello.
So I'd like you to start by first just giving us a brief, catching us up to speed on the latest of Iran's involvement in Iraq in the wake of the Kurdish bid for independence there.
Okay, so just going back now, I guess it's been about a month today, when the Kurds had their referendum to see if they were going to secede away from Iraq. The Kurds, well, that would just be Kurdistan in the northern part of Iraq. That was very successful. 93% of the Kurds said that they wanted to become their own nation. They already have a semi-autonomous state up there, run out of Erbil, but they wanted to completely break away from Baghdad. There were number of nations around the world and basically all their regional, all the nations in the region apart from Israel that said that they shouldn't go ahead with the referendum. It was going to cause trouble with their neighbors, especially Turkey, Iraq, and Iran, because all of them, well, Iraq, obviously they're part of Iraq right now, all of them are worried with or at least Iran and Turkey, because they already have their own large Kurdish populations that might see a Kurdish state being developed in Iraq, and then part of their own nations might want to break away. Anyhow, they went ahead with it, and as I said, it was very successful. And yet the following couple of weeks after that, we had the start of a blockade, economic blockade against Kurdistan. Flights were canceled from Iran, Turkey, Iraq, different nations into Kurdistan, into the Erbil airport. And then it's only intensified since then. Last week, we had the Iraqi security forces in cahoots with the Shiite militias that answer to Iran actually march on southern Kurdistan and take back territory that Kurds had held ever since 2014, the oil-rich region of Kirkuk. It's hard to get really good reporting out of or of that incursion, just because you have Kurds reporting of a number of atrocities that especially the Shiite militias are inflicting on the Kurds that remained in these territories. We won't go into too many details, but there have been a number of firefights. Prior to that incursion, though, the clue that Iran was behind it is even as we talked about on your program last week, we talked about how there was the Iranian general, Qassem Soleimani, that was in Kurdistan, in Iraq, just a couple of days before or one day before this actual ground offensive began. And so he looks like he orchestrated it. It wasn't the Iraqi state that orchestrated it, but an Iranian agent that was present inside Iraq. And now we're to the point where the United States, I guess, fearing that they were going to lose the support or the potential support or the potential alliance of the Iraqi government, actually sided with Baghdad, sided with the Iraqi government in this not necessarily incursion into Kurdistan, because they haven't gone into Kurdistan proper, but at least the returning of this land, the province of Kirkuk, to the Iraqi government. And the Kurds themselves felt betrayed by this. I can understand why they felt betrayed by this. They were coming up against the Kurdish fighters that were trying to hold the line, were fighting against the Iraqi government forces that were using American-supplied weaponry, including tanks, as well as the Iranian-directed Shiite forces in that offensive as well. And they were trying to fight against that. But of course, they didn't have the strength and they were pushed back. So that's where we are right now. And yet, on the heels of that, we had just this weekend, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson travel into the area, into the region, to try and put out some of these fires. Now that it looks like you've got one ally, which is the Iraqi government, fighting against another ally, the Kurds, and he's trying to figure out how to work this out so that the tensions die down. One thing he said over the weekend in a joint conference with, I think it was the Saudi leader plus Abadi, he called on the Iranian-backed forces to leave Iraq. He came out and said, now that the fight against the Islamic State is winding down, it's time for those Shiite forces, the Iranian-backed Shiite forces, those militias, especially the leadership of those, to go back to Iran and get out of the country. And this looks like it might be part of the U.S. strategy now. Try and find a way to befriend the Iraqi government in a way that removes the Iranian dominance over this popular mobilization units, this huge Shiite force. We'll see how successful he is at that. It doesn't look like he's going to be.
Well, yeah, let's talk about that. It's a pretty bold statement for him to make, considering just how much collusion we've seen between Iraqi and Iranian forces over the last several years. And it looks like this statement from Secretary Tillerson backfired on him pretty quickly.
Yeah, it did, because Abadi, the leader of Iraq, he came out and said the very next day, while Tillerson was actually with him in Baghdad, he flew from, I guess it was from Riyadh, they were in Jordan, and then he flew to Baghdad, and there Abadi, I think I have the quotes somewhere here, Abadi basically said that the popular mobilization units, or these fighters, these huge conglomeration of about 100,000 men that are fighting on behalf of the Iraqi government that take some of their orders from Iran, he came out in support of them. And he said the popular mobilization fighters should be encouraged because they will be the hope of the country and the region. So he's saying, no, we're not calling for their disbandment or the removal of the Iranian leaders dictate a lot of the policy of that Shiite group. And they're there to stay, it seems. He even later called, or at least his office released a statement later referring to this group as patriots, Iraqi patriots. And indeed, a lot of them are Iraqis. That's not the point, though. The point is, though, that they are an Iraqi militia that answers to Iran rather than answering to the Iraqi government.
Right, which the Iraqi prime minister apparently feels quite comfortable with.
Yeah, this was kind of shocking, actually, because you've had the United States government that has been the ally of Iraq for a long, long time. Most of the weaponry that the Iraqi forces have came from the United States, and the United States has invested a lot to try and make Iraq stable over the years. And now that the United States is recognizing in the post-Islamic State world that Iran is the one that's filling the vacuum of leadership in Iraq, the United States came out and said, hey, get those guys out of here. We don't like it. And Abadi had two choices. Either say, yeah, we would rather you be our ally, the United States, and at the expense of Iran, or we're siding with Iran. And it was a very vocal endorsement, the very first, I think, that we've seen from Abadi that he intends to side with Iran over this issue of the Shiite militias inside Iraq.
Quite remarkable. And I think you put that very well, that essentially he was forced to choose one over the other. And he made a very clear choice to demonstrate that Iran is the closer ally than the United States is. Of course, these Iranian forces or these Iranian led forces, the PMU, and the Iranian leaders came out very strongly against the American statements as well.
Yeah, one of the PMU leaders, they came out and said, your forces, talking to Tillerson, saying your forces should get ready to get out of our country once the excuse of Daesh or the Islamic State presence is over. So they're saying it's time for you to get out of here with your 5,000 men. You're done. We're going to accept the Iranians here, but your time is over. And then the foreign minister, Javad Zarif from Iran, he laughed at Tillerson's comments, and he said that the PMU couldn't go home because they are at home. And basically, he's right in that point that they are mostly Iraqis. But again, where are they taking their orders from? And this is something that a little bit of foresight should have been, there were plenty of people in the United States saying that this was going to happen. Once the Islamic State is diminished in power, somebody's going to fill the vacuum. Who's the most able? Who's got the functionality inside their governments or with their forces to fill that vacuum? It's obviously going to be Iran. We said this as well. This is from July 2016. This is from Brad McDonald in the Trumpet magazine. He said this: the rise of the Islamic State has provided Iran with the opportunity to bolster its military presence in Iraq and Syria. That's what we've seen. That's what we've seen over the past couple of years. Then he writes, Iranian officials, soldiers, and intelligence personnel are setting up offices all over Iraq and Syria, all under the guise of fighting the Islamic State. If ISIS's presence in Iraq and Syria diminishes, keep an eye on who fills the vacuum. It will be Iran. It will be Iran. It was so obvious. And I think what wasn't obvious to the United States at the time is they thought that Abadi, who has been painted as a pro-American Iraqi leader for so long, they thought that he would side with America over Iran. And we were worried about the potential leadership, or the United States was worried about the potential leadership of Iraq once there's new elections, I believe, early next year. Malaki, he is the other, the more pro-Iranian leader. And yet here we have the American, supposed American allied leader siding with Iran here.
Right. And you mentioned this article by Brad McDonald back in 2016, but we've been talking about this for what has it been, about over 26 years, I guess, going back to statements that Gerald Flory made back in 1992 about exactly this unfolding. Actually, I remember in 2003 when the United States first invaded Iraq, and we deposed Saddam Hussein, and there was this melee in the aftermath of that. And I remember the Secretary of Defense, United States Secretary of Defense, coming out and saying, well, just be assured there is not going to be an Iranian theocracy in Iraq. We're definitely not going to allow that to happen. But the Trumpet's message was consistent all the way through all of that. And we basically said, it was Donald Rumsfeld who made those comments. And we basically said, this is what the Bible prophesies, this alliance between Iraq and Iran. And it was consistent throughout that. And we really did see the removal of the strongest opponent of Iran, Saddam Hussein, as being a real boon to Iran. And it was handed to Iran by the United States. And so we've been kind of basically looking at this as being an inevitable outcome of America's incursion there in the Iraq War back in 2003 all along. But it was a decade before that Gerald Flurry made those statements based on those prophecies that we look at in Psalm 83 and Daniel 11.
Yeah, for sure. And it's just a testament to the accuracy of that forecast and Bible prophecy when you consider that there have been so many moments when people could have pointed the finger at us and say, no way. No way is that going to happen, just because even going back to 2003, when the United States was there, deposed the Iraqi leader. We had hundreds of thousands or nearly 100,000 troops there in Iraq.
Shock and awe.
Shock and awe. Yeah, right. Is Iran going to be able to take over Iraq? Look how many troops were there. And yet, in 2003, when that was going on, when the United States presence in Iraq was massive, that's when Mr. Flurry reiterated again in his piece, Is Iraq About to Fall to Iran? He said, it may seem shocking given the U.S. presence in the region right now, but prophecy indicates that in pursuit of its goal, Iran will take over Iraq, even though there's so many American troops there. Well, now we've got, it's interesting, you said there's about 5,000 deaths of United States servicemen inside Iraq in the fight there. Well, right now there's that number of troops remaining. 5,000 troops remaining in Iraq, and given that there is so little options for the United States to push its weight around with the Iraqi government, will those 5,000 troops be coming home real soon? I don't see a way that America can grab back any type of power in Iraq. They might choose to draw the line in Syria, but Iraq, now that the Kurdish state isn't going to happen, it looks like as well, they're out of options to try and push their weight around as opposed to Iran in Iraq.
Remarkable to see this developing. We've been talking with trumpet writer Brent Noctegal. We have an article on thetrumpet.com written by Callum Wood. The title is Iraq Rejects Call to Remove Iran, and it'll be appearing there if it isn't up there already. I would encourage you to go and read that. If you want more information about this, it has links to these older trumpet articles that we've been talking about and gives a little more prophetic context. It points you to the material that shows why Gerald Flurry made that prophecy 25 years ago, the scriptural passages that really informed that view and that is coming to pass right before our eyes. So we appreciate you bringing that to us, Brent. It's quite amazing to see what's going on there.
Yeah, it sure is. No problem.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
1 month ago, Japan's Prime Minister Shinzo Abe dissolved Parliament's lower house. He called for snap elections a year ahead of schedule. He said he wanted to seek the mandate of the people immediately. Well, this past Sunday, those elections were held, and he won quite handily. It could inject fresh life into his leadership. How might this affect Japan and Asia going forward? How might it play into the fulfillment of the Bible's prophecies of this region? To talk about this, we have trumpet writer Jeremiah Jacques. Hello, Jeremiah.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's good to have you. So talk about why Abe called these elections.
Well, actually, if you look all the way back to late July, Abe seemed to be on his last legs. There were two major political scandals that his administration was bogged down in. These were related to cronyism, and it just really looked like the government was showing favoritism to people that Abe was connected to. And then his defense minister was also involved in a cover-up scandal around that time. So all of this added up to really tank Shinzo Abe's approval rating. It fell down to an abysmal 26%. So at that time, it looked like for the very first time since Abe took power 5 years ago, it looked like it could be the end of his career as head of the Liberal Democratic Party and as Prime Minister of Japan. So that was toward the end of July. But now here we are toward the end of October. And as you said, Abe just won a major victory in national elections. And they've really returned his ruling coalition to power in a very decisive fashion. And basically, this was because of the North Korean threat. Mm-hmm. North Korea is the reason why he decided to call these snap elections. And as you said, it was more than a year earlier than it was necessary to hold elections. So if you look at late July, what happened between then and now mainly is two different serious incidents with North Korea. One of these was in late August, and another was about 2 weeks later in mid-September. For both of these incidents, Japanese citizens woke up to the sound of alarm sirens screaming in their ears, telling them that North Korean missiles were over their heads at that time in Japanese airspace. So there are, you know, loudspeakers are warning them to take cover in buildings or underground. They're all getting automatic text messages saying missile launch, missile launch. Nothing like this has happened in Japan ever, mm-hmm. really. And there's never been this threat level since the end of World War II. So these were just terrifying events for the Japanese people. And Prime Minister Abe saw that terror. He saw that fear, and he decided that it was time to call snap elections just to gain the necessary mandate for the hard line that he wants to take on North Korea.
Right. This plays right into his hands in a way, because one of his and perhaps the signature issue that he has pushed for is revising the constitution that prevents the development of Japan's defense forces.
Yes, that's right. In a way, you could say that Shinzo Abe owes Kim Jong-un a thank you letter.
Right.
You know, but I would also say that Abe is not just a political opportunist. He's not just manipulating things to arbitrarily increase his power. I think he is legitimately concerned about North Korea and about the threat from China and about the decreasing reliability of the United States, which has been the guarantor of Japan's security since the end of World War II.
Right. These are the issues that have really been fueling his push to put more energy into the revising the Constitution.
That's exactly right, yes. And the North Korean threat has thrown him a lifeline mm-hmm. at a time when he was poised to just slip into the history textbooks. So, yes, it really does look, though, that Japan now is closer to being able to officially revise that pacifist constitution that America wrote for it at the end of World War II than it has been at any time in the last 70, 75 years.
And just briefly, what exactly is Abe trying to accomplish in revising the constitution?
Well, he would like for Japan to have... His eventual goal, I believe, is for Japan to be a full-fledged military power, able to be involved in military arenas anywhere in the world. Mm-hmm. And so we've seen gradual steps, even as early as 1954, not even a decade after the end of World War II, the SDF was created. That's the self-defense force of Japan. And they've always said, this is strictly for self-defense. Mm-hmm. Japan cannot be involved in any sort of military action off of its immediate territory. And it cannot be involved in collective self-defense, meaning it can't join the U.S. Military in any way, or U.N. forces or Australian forces, those of any of its allies. But in the years since then, since 1954, there have just been little pushes along the way, little pushes here and there to allow Japan, that force that is officially strictly for self-defense, to become just to have more and more leeway for offensive sorts of activities.
So after this election this past Sunday, pretty decisive victory, about two-thirds majority for his party. Where does this leave him now politically? You said that this really kind of threw him a lifeline, but in terms of being able to push through these constitutional reforms, how far along does this put him on that road?
Well, he now has a two-thirds, what's called a supermajority, in both the upper and the lower houses of parliament. So that gives him the ability to push through even fairly divisive and controversial legislation. However, to amend the Constitution, he would need not only approval from both houses of Parliament, which he could easily get now, but he would need a public referendum to also approve it. And that's where he still has some major hurdles to cross. Hmm. So the government would be able to do it, but without the public giving, I believe it's a 50%, just the majority has to approve it. And at present, polls show that the public is still quite divided. You know, Japan has benefited immensely in economic terms from being able to say, you know what, we rely on America for our defense. Right. We don't have to spend as much money as all these other countries in the world do. And they've been able to grow very wealthy, being able to keep more of their GDP devoted to, domestic programs and education and things like that, instead of having to spend as much as most nations.
Right.
On military. So it's still a battle. It's still a real hurdle for him to convince, especially the younger generations. You know what? We should, I know that you are far more prosperous than our neighbors that we see in China and in Vietnam and in all these other countries, but we need to dispense with this strange arrangement that has in many ways facilitated and built up our prosperity. So it's a bit of a battle, but he's better poised to win that battle than he ever has been.
Well, and do you feel like it's primarily just that economic aspect of it that say is causing so many Japanese, so much of the public to say that they would oppose a revision of the Constitution? Are there any concerns based on Japan's militaristic history or that type of thing, or people who are trying to keep a distance from that aspect of their own history?
Well, that's a great question, and I would say that does factor into it to a degree.
You see that in Germany.
Yes.
And really the same reasoning that they've had this reliance on the United States that's enabled them to spend more in other arenas. Yeah. And yet you have this push increasingly toward militarism, at least on the part of certain elites within Germany. Is it a similar type of scenario there?
I believe it is similar in a way. One major difference is that Japan is less contrite about their World War II sins than Germany. With Germany, it's been, very public acknowledgement of the Holocaust, even to the point of banning Holocaust denial, banning Mein Kampf up until just a year or so ago. Mm-hmm. In Japan, you haven't really seen that same level of contrition. You've even seen a reluctance by the elite to apologize to the Chinese and the South Koreans and other countries that they just savagely invaded and just committed these horrible atrocities against. There's been a reluctance to apologize, a reluctance to admit guilt and blame. And when there have been apologies, they've been almost regularly undercut by these elite right-wing nationalists who say, you know what, we don't have anything to apologize for. Mm-hmm. We are a proud country, and we warred like anyone else wars. Mm-hmm. And so,
well, how much daylight is there, say, between Abe, who does have more of those nationalistic tendencies, and his association with groups that are far more even proud of Japan's history, and the public, who is maybe less inclined that way? If he needs 50% majority to get this Constitution amendment passed, and you would presume that the more saber rattling, the greater the threat there is from North Korea, from China, and elsewhere, that the more you would see public support moving. Where is public support now, and how different is it from, say, Abe's own views?
Well, public support now is close to 50-50, and that's the best it's been in favor of revising the Constitution for decades and decades, possibly since the Constitution by the U.S. was written for Japan. So it is a trend that Abe and the hardliners, the hawks, they're slowly winning this battle. Mm-hmm. The public, as they see the threat from North Korea intensifying, as they hear, warning sirens blaring in their ears, they're saying, wow, yeah, it would be nice if we could live in a peaceful world and not have to worry about
right.
being a military power, but they hear it with their ears. They see it with their eyes. North Korea is a viable and a very dangerous threat. China, it's a little quieter these days because of the North Korean distraction, but the Japanese are very alarmed about China's belligerence, especially in the East China Sea, which is right next to Japan there. And so because of that increasing belligerence from both North Korea and China, more and more members of the public are saying, we really do need to be ready to defend ourselves and to even take some offensive actions when it's appropriate.
Mm-hmm. It's quite remarkable to see this taking place, this shift over such a short period within Japan, at the same time that we're seeing the same kind of trend play out in Germany, in Austria, in Poland, in other European countries, elsewhere within Asia. And we talked about it a little bit last Friday after the Kurz election, that this gravitation of the public towards strongmen and just trying to invest more power in the hands of their governments in order to deal with the rising threats in the world is really extraordinary. And it does fit with the model of end time events that we see in biblical prophecy.
That's exactly right. If a nation wants to be able to play a larger role on the international stage and have a little more weight in the global arena, what you almost always see is power being channeled into one man. Mm-hmm. And that way bureaucracy is done away with and actions are taken, you know, that may not democratically represent everyone in the country, but they're taken decisively and quickly and with resolution that you can't have when there's, you know, a board of directors governing everything.
Right. So looked at this prophetically, what stands out to you, say, maybe beyond the singular strongman idea that we were just talking about?
Well, the Bible has quite a lot to say on the topic of what Scripture terms the kings of the East. Mm-hmm. This is an end-time Asian bloc, a group of many Asian nations. The Bible actually specifies in Revelation 9, verse 16, that this Asian group will have an army of 200 million soldiers, which is far above any army that the world has ever seen. And so the Scriptures do reveal in Ezekiel 38 and 39 especially, that Russia will be at the helm of this bloc. It'll be led by Russia. But if you only look at Russia's population, you can't get anywhere near those 200 million men for the army.
Right.
So the details of that scripture, the passages there in Ezekiel 38 especially, show that China will be kind of in a secondary leadership position alongside the Russians there. And then Ezekiel 38 verse 6 specifies that Gomer and Togarmah will be a part of this Asian power bloc. And these are the ancient names for the main peoples who make up modern Japan. Mm. And so when we see Japan today marching toward militarism, just abandoning those shackles that were put on it at the end of World War II, and when we reflect back on what a fierce military power it was during the Second World War and in the lead up to it, and then you look at these scriptures, it's just really alarming to see how Japan will fit into this Kings of the East power block and just all the military technology and the soldiers as well. They've got quite an impressive population. So Japan, I believe, will, or it's easy to see with these scriptures, that Japan will play a major role in that Kings of the East power block that will be so vital in the World War III altercation.
Well, it's very fascinating. We've been talking with trumpet writer Jeremiah Jacques about Japan's elections this past Sunday. We have an article on thetrumpet.com. The title is Shinzo Abe Gains Two-Thirds Majority in Snap Elections. It gives a little more context. It also points to a trend article. We have these articles posted on thetrumpet.com that give you the reasoning and the context for why we're watching specific trends in world events. And we have a trend article on Japan militarizing that gives the whole story about, as we've followed this since World War II and Japan looking to revise its constitution and boost its military power, and putting that in its prophetic context, a little more than what Jeremiah is able to do in a short radio segment here, but definitely worth studying. It's an outstanding article that really does help you to understand this trend and to see where this is leading. So we do encourage you to go to thetrumpet.com and check that out. And Jeremiah, thank you for your time.
Thanks for letting me be here.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
Pope Francis comes across to many people as a mild, humble, simple, even harmless man, but the reality is that he's proving himself to be quite tough in a number of ways, and believe it or not, he's actually taking steps that weaken the power of the Roman Curia, the administration of the Holy See, and concentrate more power in his own office, in the papacy. To talk about this, we have via Skype from our office in Britain, trumpet writer Andrew Miller. Hello, Andrew.
Hello.
So let's start by just talking about the Curia. Just tell us about how important this is, what its responsibilities are, and just the role that it plays within the Vatican, the Holy See.
Right. Well, the Vatican is very unique in that, or the Catholic Church is very unique, is that it's both a church and a state. You're probably, most of our listeners are more familiar with the Roman Catholic Church, but it's also a nation state, independent from Italy, carved out of the center of Rome, called Vatican City. And the Curia is basically the bureaucratic apparatus of this nation state, just like the United States has a bunch of different bureaucracies like the IRS and the EPA and these. The Vatican State also has its bureaucracies that help the Pope run and manage both Vatican City and the Roman Catholic Church. And that's called the Roman Curia. Hasn't always been there in its current form. I think its current constitution was put in place in 1988. But it's more or less been the same since the 16th century that the popes really relied on this bureaucracy to help him manage the Roman Catholic Church globally.
Okay, so tell us about these moves that the Pope is making. How is he undercutting the authority of the Curia? And maybe give us a sense of why he might be doing that.
Right. Well, also, I guess similar to the United States, both the Curia, like the U.S., what you'd call the deep states, really grown in power over the last many decades to the point where it's gotten somewhat unwieldy, even with a mind of its own. And you'll our longtime listeners will remember back from almost 5 years ago. When Pope Benedict resigned, shocked the world, became the first pope in over 600 years to resign. He resigned because of this infighting within the Curia. There were factions within this bureaucracy opposing each other. A lot of scandals that were revealed dramatically to the press when the Pope's butler leaked a lot of confidential documents. Or as the story goes, it hit Pope Benedict all at once just how much reform was going to be needed to get rid of this infighting. And at his age, he didn't feel he could do it. So he stepped down for a younger pope, or young by
papal
standards anyway. Yeah. He's still a fresh, bright-eyed 76-year-old with one lung named George Bergoglio came sweeping into power and was really elected kind of on a mandate that he was going to be the one to reform the Curia and stop this infighting. And a lot of people have kind of been surprised or disappointed at how little Curia reform has gone on in the past almost 5 years. But when you look a little closer, you'll find that it looks like he's going through a much different strategy. And instead of reforming the Curia, he's either downsizing or circumventing it.
Okay. So what sort of moves is he making?
Well, the first thing he did, and he didn't waste any time with this, only like a month into his papacy back in 2013, is he appointed a new council of cardinal advisors, kind of colloquially known as the Vatican C9. Like it's a playoff, like you have the G8 on the economics.
I get you.
And this is brought in 9 cardinals. One was the Vatican Secretary of State, and the rest were regional cardinals from the 6 inhabited continents that could come in and he'd advise him on Curia reform. Although all the cardinals he chose, with the exception of maybe George Pell from Australia, were well-known liberal or progressive cardinals that really agreed with the Pope on a lot of the new issues he wanted to take, that he could now use them as kind of like his sounding board or his communication means with the Roman Catholic Church instead of going through the traditional Curia offices. So any of these decisions that maybe in the past would get caught up in the bureaucracy, he could just kind of jump skip around that.
I see. So, and circumventing the Curia, new body that he created, you said this is mostly advisory, or is this actually a way of implementing some of these changes that he wants to do?
Well, it's mostly advisory, but for the that is more significant than it sounds. Is that, I guess, in theory, the Roman Catholic Church has always been an absolute monarchy. The Pope can make what decisions he want as long as he's not changing what we'd consider Catholic dogma. But in practice, the Curia's kind of act as the main check and balance on the Pope's power. And so, but even by bringing in advisors, that is that can kind of keep him informed of other things going on the ground, is really an important way to be able to just kind of circumvent that bureaucratic apparatus. And you can really see that as a kind of on advice from the Curia, or not advice from the Curia, but advice from this board of cardinal advisors. He's started to delegate more authority to the local bishops' conference, as every nation has its local episcopal conference. You've got like the United States Episcopal Conference. The EU actually has their own for the bloc. That was kind of controversial in that he published an exhortation in 2016 with the support of his council advisors, saying that Catholics who'd been divorced could get remarried in certain circumstances that weren't necessarily in line with what the Congregation of the Doctrine of the Faith had published, but he kind of left it up to the local bishops. And that was something that Cardinal Gerhard Mueller, who was the prefect of the Congregation of the Doctrine of the Faith, really came out against as a member of the Curia, who was thinking that the Pope was overstepping his bounds there. And end up losing his job probably over that. The Pope didn't renew his position for a second 5-year term, and as a matter of fact, kind of stated that no one in the Curia was going to be serving for more than 5 years. So he's just trying to keep the Curia on the just kind of like a rotating board, so no one gets too comfortable in that position, and then giving more authority to these local bishops' conferences, which this is something that a lot of Vatican watchers have expressed concern over, saying, like, well, if you let Germany make different guidelines than Poland on who can get remarried after their divorce, that threatens to split the church. But another way of looking at it, as you mentioned, is that if Germany and Poland don't necessarily have to go to the Congregation of the Doctrine of the Faith to get a blanket decision there, that kind of leaves the Pope as himself, like the person of Pope Francis, as the only one who's arbitrating those types of decisions.
Right. So that's really the crux of the issue here, isn't it? He's acting in ways that in decentralizing power in a way that circumvents the Curia, he's actually at the same time concentrating power within his own office.
Right. Actually, when I was talking with this with my colleague Richard Palmer earlier in the day, he actually had a kind of a neat historical example. He said in medieval England, kind of the same thing happened with the king, where the main check on the king's power was the aristocracy. And so the king actually started delegating more authority to the House of Commons, to the common people, in medieval society, which by giving more power to the common people, it weakened the nobles. But the nobles were the main check on the king's power, so the king actually became more more powerful himself. And so the king got power and the common people got power, and it was the middleman who kind of got squeezed out of there. And that really seems kind of be the strategy Pope Francis is taking this, is by taking some of these what would be considered in the grand scheme of thing minor decisions, like, okay, who gets an annulment, who can get remarried after their divorce, who translates this text into a particular local language, and start letting the local bishops' conference do that instead of the Vatican bureaucracy. That weakens the bureaucracy, and so if the local bishops' conference have any disputes, they have to go to the Pope himself, which makes him well, according to a lot of Vatican watchers, they say he's probably the most powerful pope in a century.
So if you look at this historically, if he's the most powerful pope in a century, it's really talking about the rise of the Curia as sort of a locus of power within the church. If that power is being diffused and reconcentrated, maybe locally and in the position of the Pope, maybe just put this in a little broader historical context for us. How strange is it, I guess, for the Pope to embrace more what some are calling autocratic measures the way that he is? How foreign is this type of thinking to Roman Catholicism?
Well, it's definitely a big change for the last couple centuries. But when you look at the vast, almost 2,000-year history of the Roman Catholic Church, it's not necessarily out of character. Throughout most of the Middle Ages, the Curia wasn't nearly the force it is today. And so it was really the kind of the person of the Pope who was ruling the Roman Catholic Church. And it's only been since about the 1500s or the end of the Middle Ages that the Catholic Church started to spread out of Europe and overseas, they started bringing in the Curia to help with some of these administrative functions, which then kind of really took over a lot of power. So it is, in a lot of ways, it is kind of a return to the model that they had during the time of the Habsburg Golden Age and before.
So put this in prophetic context for us, because this is obviously our real concern over this. There would be some people who would just be watching to see how strong or weak this Pope's decisions are going to make the Catholic Church. But we're looking at this through the lens of biblical prophecy. Just help us to understand it from that perspective.
Right. Well, especially from longtime listeners and students of Bible prophecy will be well familiar with it. Like Revelation 13, Revelation 17 talks about a great false church called a Mystery Babylon the Great that arises in the end time and guides a resurrection of the Holy Roman Empire. Some of these same chapters and intervening chapters specifically call out the leader of that church as the false prophet, showing that this is someone who has like a one-man rule in this church. And as we've pointed out in our literature and our magazine many times before, it even talks about verses in Isaiah 47 about this, the leader of this church says, "I won't suffer the loss of daughters or the churches that have rebelled against them in the past," and like Protestant churches who have protested against their mother will come back into the fold. And so some ways what you see Pope Francis doing is fulfilling two different prophecies. The second one is that by giving more power to these episcopal conferences, it gives bishops in, say, a nation like Germany a little more leniency to tweak small doctrines here or there to make unity or cooperation with the Lutheran Church more likely, mm-hmm. while other bishops in Greece can tweak a little things here or there that make unity with the Eastern Orthodox Church more likely. You don't necessarily have to be exact micromanage every individual little nation. And not that I'm saying there's going to be major doctrinal differences, but I know there in some Eastern Orthodox country, it's kind of, it gets to the point where the Orthodox bishops say that a priest should have a beard and the Catholic bishops say that a priest should be clean shaven. And they're pretty sure that unity is a no deal unless you can give the regional conferences a little bit of leeway here to allow for individual facial hair choices. But and so in some ways, by the decentralization to the local bishops' conferences is allowing for that unity with Protestant and Orthodox churches to happen more easily. But at the same time, the Pope's not necessarily surrendering his authority to let that happen. Mm-hmm. He's taking power from the Curia and either deciding which of that's going to go to the local conferences to have cultural differences and which comes back to himself, which also really kind of leads into this prophecy about the when it talks about a false prophet in Revelation 16. It doesn't talk like about the false committee or the false bureaucracy, right, or the false curial office. This is a church that does have one man rule.
Yeah. Well, pretty fascinating to watch this happening. We've been talking with trumpet writer Andrew Miller about political developments within the Roman Catholic Church. He's written an article, Is the Papacy Becoming More Authoritarian? I'd encourage you to go online. Not only does it give a little more prophetic context, what he was getting into at the tail end there, but it also provides a link to Herbert W. Armstrong's booklet, Who or What is the Prophetic Beast, which really gives a lot of biblical proof for the identity of the Catholic Church in prophecy. There's also a link to a Key of David program by trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury on that same biblical subject, Who or What is the Prophetic Beast. So it does give you quite a bit more context to this specific subject that Andrew is talking about here, and it'll help you to understand it from the Bible's point of view. We appreciate your time, Andrew. That's really interesting information that you've presented to us. Thanks for giving it.
Thanks for having me on the show.
It's time for today's last word.
What is life without passion? If you're really excited about what you're doing, whether it be your work or other activities, your family and the people in your life, if you're really devoting your heart to it, you're going to be far more effective at it. Those activities, those relationships will be more satisfying and enjoyable. But so much of the time, we don't have that passion naturally. Naturally, we tend to cruise along, allow ourselves to give the minimum effort, to become complacent. Naturally, we tend to take things for granted. We don't have enough of the right kind of positive, passionate emotion toward what we do and toward the people in our life. Every so often, you see someone who seems like he was just born with passion for his career, for sports or music or whatever the activity. But generally, if you're going to have passion, you have to cultivate it. You have to nurture it and work at it. There are a lot of influences in society that tend to discourage the right kind of passion. We have a lot of things that distract our attention. We get into a routine, into a groove. There are a lot of things that can kill the right kind of emotion. But passion is something we need to actively, intentionally build. I'm going to give you 3 points on how to build passion. The first is action inspires passion. Action inspires passion. If you know that you should do something, then go ahead and do it. Don't wait to feel inspired about it. Just act. it's also true that passion inspires action, and there really is a virtuous cycle here. Kyle Eschenroeder wrote this in a book that he wrote called Meditations on the Wisdom of Action. Our fatal mistake is waiting to be motivated before we take action. Action motivates. I don't feel like working out until I get my blood flowing. I don't want to go to the party until I'm there. If you act, the motivation will follow. He says, instead of waiting to feel like working toward who you'd like to be, act in line with that desire and the feelings will follow. Act to become. Proverbs 16 and verse 3 says, commit your works unto the eternal and your thoughts shall be established. That's a really profound statement. The deed precedes the thought. The action precedes and inspires the passion. The second point is, think through what really makes you passionate. It's not necessarily what it seems like on the surface, not necessarily the activity, but something about the activity. Communication coach Carmen Gallo talks with speakers regularly about how to really build passion in their presentations. And he says this, dig deep to identify your unique and meaningful connection to your presentation topic. Passion leads to mastery, and your presentation is nothing without it, but keep in mind that what fires you up might not be the obvious. That's why you really have to dig. What excites you about that thing? That thing that you really like, that thing you enjoy, what is it that really fires you up about it? Maybe you love working on electronics, but what you're really excited about is being able to fix someone else's broken iPhone. You enjoy helping other people and having a skill that's of use to other people. That's what your real passion is. The third point is get passionate about what God is passionate about. And this is really the most important. As the Bible says, His thoughts are higher than our thoughts, and we have to rise up to reach those thoughts. God is so passionate, and it is something that we have to go after. That takes digging. It takes really investing some time in learning what it is that God is fired up about, and then trying to build more of that excitement and that enthusiasm in our life. He wants us to really be passionate. For example, the Bible says that the fervent, effectual prayer of the righteous man avails much in the book of James. Fervent and effectual prayers. Weak prayers aren't effective, but passionate prayers, energetic prayers, those can really make a difference. And if we're praying for God's mind, if we're asking God for the right kind of emotion and the right kind of passion, He's going to hear that. If we're persistent and we keep going back to Him and ask in faith, then He will give us that passion. Build more passion in your life. Take action and realize that that is going to build more of that motivation and enthusiasm. Consider your motivations and understand what really tends to stir your passion and seek to stir up more emotion about the very things that God is passionate about. It takes effort, it takes work, but the more you do it, the more motivated you'll be, the more successful and effective will be your activities and your relationships, and the more satisfaction and joy you'll have in your life. I'm Joel Hilliker. That's it for today's Trumpet Hour. Send us your comments on the program by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks so much to my guests, Brent Noctegal, Jeremiah Jacques, and Andrew Miller. Thanks to our staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you with this thought from Joshua Loth Liebman. Treasure each other in the recognition that we do not know how long we shall have each other. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. understand your world.